I think it's okay to start. We've got a couple minutes past four. Welcome on a Saturday afternoon. If anybody's taping this, my name is Jonathan Ferrix, and this is a session called Let Us Be Nuclear Free. I'm looking around and thinking that almost nobody was here earlier in the week. I see. How many people have been to more than two sessions?
Probably.
Okay.
Since Monday, yeah.
I just thought to maybe spend a little bit of a time in a mini review today, and then to try to offer, I've been saving up some of the good news, and maybe it's a mistake to save it till the last session. But we had a foretaste of the good news in the session yesterday, and I think that's the place to start our review. I asked people. The mini review is going to be, you know, what are nuclear weapons humanly, environmentally, financially, and spiritually? And let's start with spiritually, in the sense that it will come up throughout the session, but I think an entry point for it is what happened when we asked people yesterday, what Bible verses come to your mind as being relevant to us in the light of the gospel, but also, and nuclear weapons, but also in the light of our Holden theme this year, this summer, all the promises of God. Because the sad thing is that nuclear weapons do a better job of abrogating the promises of God than almost anything else you could think of. Certainly in all of these spheres and several more. So on the spiritual side, how do we come equipped? And these were some of the examples that people gave. After the flood, God promising never to again destroy the earth. So even though we're giving him a run for, or her a run for God's money, we are people of hope. And we heard in the Bible study, hope against hope. God has promised us life. So this being incompatible with the life that we're meant to be leading, we're informed by that, and we're guided forward by that. Another beautiful Bible verse to start from is obviously the great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. A little hard to do that if you have a gun pointed to his head. Blessed are the peacemakers, Micah 6:8, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Justice, mercy, humility. John 3:16, God so loved the world. What does that tell us about how we're supposed to take care of it? Maybe one more. Hunger and thirsting for righteousness. Hunger and thirsting for righteousness. What about the world is upheld if we look upon our status quo internationally? There are people who absolutely believe nuclear weapons will never be done away with, impossible to do away with them. And that we then cannot... I think honestly say hunger and thirst after righteousness. On the very quickly through a couple of the other things, there's many, many ways to note the human costs of nuclear weapons. And I think when I say humanly, I should put a slash there automatically and say militarily. You know, because they are very problematic for soldiers and generals to use. Why? Because they are almost unusable. And the more honest people among the military will tell you that. And a lot of the people who leave the ministry and who leave the government, increasing numbers, they're having a conversion late in life, and you'll see some on a video in a minute. Some of the most famous people in our country coming out now after they're out of public service, after distinguished careers, to say, we've got to get rid of these things. I think the human cost is best demonstrated by the fact that we have been able, see that little dot there before I put the Y there? That dot is meant to represent, I'm talking about the power, the brute power and killing power of nuclear weapons. That dot represents, we've got handouts for this, all the explosives used in World War II, including the two bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay, that's the dot. This dot, 350 times World War II, 350 times the explosive power used in World War II. Is what? It's the total explosive power of the US and Russian weapons only that are on high alert. Still, Cold War, 10 to 20 to 30 minute launch on warning status, where the president at one point has to get a briefing for 30 seconds from the chief of staff and make a decision about whether or not to shoot back because apparently things are coming our way. That's the numbers that, sitting 20 years after the Cold War on one of the weirdest devices come to during the Cold War, about how we're meant to be in a status of equilibrium with our great rival Russia, which is where now today? Not Russia, so USSR.
Doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist, but theirs on warning and we're on warning. And there's a lot of details, not time to go into. 850 times World War II, 850 times World War II. The explosive power, that dot, this is meant to be 850 times bigger circle, it's actually not in proportion, is the total explosive power, the detonative power of the US and Russian arsenals, complete nuclear arsenals. And when we had more than, this is actually something like 12% of what we had in the 70s. The arsenals we have today is something like 12%. So when I did this earlier in the week, I drew another circle, 2,400 times World War II is what we all were party to about 30 years ago in the depths of the Cold War. There'll be psychiatrists lining up to treat us in world history when they look back on this period. I also took a big leap. And I said that this stuff here doesn't come cheap. To maintain this arsenal, our part of it, the US part of it, which is about a little under half, the Russians actually have more than we do of these things, 23,000 warheads. To maintain those, we spend about $55 billion a year, $55 billion a year. Okay? And that $55 billion just happens to be a number of good things. One of the good things it happens to be about the amount of money it would cost to achieve per each year the Millennium Development Goals, the goals set by all the world's leaders in 2000 as this new millennium began, to do some really basic things. And there's eight of them, you can look them up online, but basically eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. So move half the people who are on $1 a day, move them to $2 a day or $3 a day through income generation and job training and all kinds of things. Half the people, reduce by half the number of people suffering from hunger. Second one, achieve universal primary education. Every human being on the planet ought to go to primary school. A very achievable goal. Third, promote gender equity, and they only say it by eliminating the disparity in education between males and females. Fourth, reduce child mortality, reduce by two-thirds the number of kids that die before they get to five. And it keeps going like that, with very specific and achievable things. The total cost to achieve those is about what we spend every year on our weapons. And I think if you want to get the tone of what I'd like you to be thinking about, it would be that this money would make us, I'm not suggesting it's reasonable for the US to pay for this for the world, but we'd have to pay a certain chunk of this. And if we paid a lot of it, other people would come to the table and pay for it as well. But I am completely sure this amount of money would make us infinitely more secure than this, what we spend on this. And that's a good segue to the discussion of the financial costs. I spent some time talking about something called the atomic audit. And there's a project by civil society that took all costs between 1946 and 1996. What did Uncle Sam spend his and our money on in those 50 years? And the answer is, well, $13.2 trillion. I've got the percentages somewhere, but a huge chunk of it went to defense without nuclear weapons. Just the other kinds of defense. The next biggest thing was 7.8 to Social Security, 7.8 $1 trillion. That's a dollar with 12 zeros after it. 7.8 trillion dollars. So the next all is nuclear all by itself. $5.8 trillion for nuclear weapons, the arsenal that used to be 2,400 times World War II, but has been, we've been spending money mightily. And the amazing thing about this was, when these guys did it, nobody on the planet knew, except God, knew what that number was. And they worked for 4 years and added up what the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Department of Energy, and everybody else had spent. And they came to this figure. Just for comparison, what's next? $5.3 trillion for income support, food stamps, women, WIC. Is he still in the program, WIC?
Yeah.
Welfare, other forms of welfare. Then interest on the national debt, 4.7. This one's probably taking a nice jump right now with what's been happening at the end of the last administration, beginning of this one. And then Medicare, 2.3. And after that, they just drop down. You like highways? They're cheap. They hardly get off the bottom line here. You like education? Cheap. You know, nothing, no problem. So it's a sense of national priorities that I think is especially troubling. If we take this one, our third biggest priority, very graciously separated from military, which should actually be combined, and it should be this high. So then this becomes, what is it? Put those two together, it becomes three times this. So Social Security is one third as important to us. I think it's interesting to talk and think in those directions because of the way in which they inform us about what we have chosen to do.
Question out here.
Yeah.
Could I just ask just a little bit of clarification of where some of the details may fall into? Because you mentioned if you took and added up what the Army, the Navy had done, and also the Department of Energy, which kind of alludes to something that I was going to ask, which is my understanding is that the nuclear arsenal is under the budget of the Department of Energy, right?
The bombs are free to the Pentagon.
Right,
because they're under DOE.
That's right. Yeah. So when every year they parade out the expense that we have for military spending, and we see that the percentage is such and such, the nuclear arsenal's not included. So now, for the delivery vehicles, okay. So under that nuclear, does the cost of that nuclear include the delivery vehicles for the?
Yeah. You know,
as opposed to conventional missiles, which would be under the military.
Yeah. Let me show you a graph later.
Okay.
I've got a breakdown of pie chart. 55% of the weapons are cheap. So-called, you know, 55% of this 5.8 trillion. By the way, now it's 7.5 trillion because we kept spending at the same rate since this was completed. But 55% of that cost is the deployment of the weapons. So all the stuff to deploy them, and there's a huge chunk for protection, and some for dismantlement. It's all there in the 5.8 trillion.
Okay. So deployment is pretty important. I remember when China got the bomb. They had no way of taking it anywhere.
Yeah.
All they could do is blow themselves up with it. So
yeah.
It does change things a little bit.
Now, I would like to pretend that that's a little introduction and a review of the week. There was a lot more and some good discussion from all the people that came. And I'd like to go to a sort of a summary of that sort of discussion and to ask you to think with me about. Think of nuclear danger as a deadly double standard, a nuclear threat, the nuclear danger that we live with, as a deadly double standard that's incompatible with almost the deepest things you can think about. It doesn't wipe them out immediately, but it puts them at risk in a way that's completely unacceptable. Hopefully you get a bit of a sense that God's promises take a real beating here. I didn't even talk about the human cost here. I should do the environmental one first. I skipped it. I got to do that. But incompatible with the sanctity of life. And that's an old idea. Remember one of our favorite Christians of the last century, Albert Schweitzer? That was one of his main comments on as a doctor, as a philanthropist, as a creative person. he brought that up very strongly, I think, in a joint statement with Bertrand Russell. Well, that was Russell and Einstein did that. But sanctity of life becomes nowhere more clear if it isn't enough to talk about how many people die when you talk about the environmental costs. And I don't even want to mention the cost to the people whose land the uranium is found on, where it's mined, the people who work in the process of mining it and refining it and building it into weapons. Forget all that. But when you drop a nuclear bomb, and if you drop them on cities, and if you drop them on cities in modest numbers, so this the following statistic is from the use of 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs. And a Hiroshima-sized bomb is nothing. It's 15,000 tons of TNT. Nothing. The tiniest weapons that exist today, basically. If India and Pakistan used their weapons, 100 of them on each other, which is about the kind of weapon some of them have, 20 million people die in a blast. Probably 60 million would die from the radiation and the burns and things that kill you in the later weeks. In Japan, 2 to 3 times as many people died in the aftermath as during the actual blast. But here's the kicker. The same guys who brought you the nuclear winter phenomenon. Remember, who's here old enough to remember nuclear winter? 1970s? Two of them are still researching, and they took the IPCC's, the International Panel on Climate Change, the UN 1500 scientists, who 40% of us don't believe are right. Their computers, the best climate modeling computers that are in existence, and they used them to redo the math on their prediction of nuclear winter. And they found out they were really not wrong at all, but actually it was going to be quite a bit worse. Because when you use weapons on cities, rather than on atolls or deserts or oceans, like they tested them on before they went underground with them, when you use them on cities, you vaporize the city and turn it into carbon and push it up into the upper atmosphere. And so there's a website called nucleardarkness.org. If you like to go out of Holden and remember some of your finest, most pleasant memories, nucleardarkness.org. And you can dial in a 5-megaton weapon, which is a gazillion times more powerful than Hiroshima, and drop it in the middle of the city that you don't like very much, and then watch the black cloud of soot go into the upper atmosphere and go around the world. So in the India-Pakistan scenario, those cities would be vaporized. You'd have this unconscionable loss of life going on. But then, within 6 days, the world would be shrouded in dust, in soot, at super high altitudes, which would stay there for 10 years. Global temperatures would drop by 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 degrees Celsius, growing seasons would drop by 15 days. And if you're an American farmer with fertilizers and everything else, you can probably live with 15 days less growing season. You'd make less money, there'd be less, food prices would certainly rise, etc. But consider the billion people who live on a dollar a day, who are also the most food insecure people on Earth, and how many of them would make it if they lost 15 days from their growing seasons. So climate change in the other direction, caused by this misuse of energy compared to the other misuse of energy, which is climate change in the direction of heat, as we slowly work our way towards another form of disaster. This one we do it in a heartbeat. We misuse energy in a heartbeat. And the specter of it is there. Now, is India-Pakistan war likely to happen? Probably no more so than Russia-US was. Should we count on that record to keep us safe? Is that a great way to go on forward into a new century when we need to cooperate to solve things imminently more difficult than this, especially climate? So I speak of nuclear weapons abolition as the training wheels on the bicycle of climate change management and remediation. And ironically, this is also the figure. So if you don't want to help poor people with development goals and you just want to help everybody with the climate, this is exactly the figure, roughly, that is needed for to reverse climate change, the process of climate change. If you look at what they were talking about before the Copenhagen meeting, it'll come up next again this year at Cancun. Interesting that our greatest affronts to God's promises cost about the same as fixing the things we haven't done to kind of keep up with God's promises. So thinking of it, a deadly double standard, incompatible with the sanctity of life, and turning to an alternative to narrow national security, which is really what we're talking about. This is a nation-state problem. It's the Treaty of Westphalia's revenge about 400 years later, something we need to get beyond, at least in some areas of life, where what we do in our country absolutely doesn't stop there, but goes abroad. And a term I like to contrast with narrow national security is shared human security. So putting human security in front of national security, and narrow, or you know, what you get your high marks for as a politician, if you really hit that national security, put shared there, because you're sharing it with other people that inhabit this planet. And in that light, abolition of nuclear weapons is not the end point of some long and impossible road that, you know, people that are holding at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon don't want to hear about, let alone most of us in most of our life. I'm paid to worry about this. It's half of my job. And I may be the only person in an international church organization with that in my portfolio. I'm not sure. I haven't met anybody else in quite the same spot, which is a pretty sad statement about priorities. But don't think of it as an endpoint of a long and weary road that we might not be able to make towards disarmament, putting the genie back in the bottle, at least in having all the weapons ready and able to be used. Think of it as the starting point for a new agenda of global action, starting point for what we can do together in the coming decades as the world comes to terms with its interdependency and its shared responsibility for the life that God has given us. And in that light, I'll present a little bit of thinking about that, which kind of summarizes some of the things that we've heard here in the last four sessions. Shared security means living up to the same standards. All three Abrahamic faiths believe that the one God has made everyone in God's image and that all people are inherently of equal value. Double standards are untenable in terms of faith. Double standards are also untenable in matters of life and death. Laced through the factors that break the circle of shared security are double standards. These are inimical to shared security and to peace. They support a two-tier world, a world of nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots, of powerful and weak, so-called, of rich and poor, of accountable and unaccountable, of obligations met versus obligations not met, of domination for the few and vulnerability for the many. I haven't gone into details, but everybody probably knows there are 9 nuclear powers, 5 legal ones, 4 outlaw ones, and then there are 184 other countries who said, we don't want these things. That's the few and the many. Okay, so 9, it was 5 to 184, but then Israel revealed what it was up to, India revealed what they were up to, Pakistan revealed what they were up to, and North Korea said, well, we could do that, and they revealed what they're up to. So we have 9 to 184. Double standards are a conspicuous part of military doctrines that govern and protect the weapons programs. Why do some states have the right to these weapons and most others do not? Only because they were conceded that right by the majority of nations. And just an aside here, another thing I tried to go through earlier in the week was the idea in American history of the power of the idea of dominance over against the power of the idea of consent. And if you look at our history, we exercise a lot of dominance thinking to this very day. But we also have a strong, one of the best traditions in the world, I think, of consent, the consent of the governed. Many good things in our Constitution, in our history, and in our system of government. But if you talk of consent, only weapons can only be held by those who have conceded that right, a temporary right, a temporary concession that was agreed as a necessary goal to achieve a single standard, the elimination of nuclear weapons. So in 1970, when the treaty that says you, USA, and Russia, and China, and Britain, and France, you can keep your weapons as long as you agree to get rid of them, and in return for that, we will agree never to get them. So 184 said the last, 5 said the first. The others stayed out, and we're still kind of stuck in that bargain. The only problem is that the promise to get rid of them didn't have a timeline. And think it said eventually. And there are people who say that the big powers who put this over actually never really intended to get rid of them. I choose not to believe that, because if you don't believe the best words people say, you don't have any starting point in a tough issue like this. I think eventually is a slightly positive word. This special right can be seen as an agreement to identify and begin to limit an unacceptable situation until such time as it is fully resolved. The majority ascribed a special status to the minority as an exit strategy from the nuclear nightmare of mutually assured destruction and all those things. The minority had acquired nuclear weapons as if it could be a political and military fait accompli, but allowing a few to have the bomb was not sustainable. The majority could not accept it, but they agreed to the continuation of a de facto double standard as part of a dynamic bargain that would lead to resolution of the discrepancy. We will not seek the bomb on the condition that you give yours up, they were saying in that treaty, the NPT treaty. It was a pragmatic political bargain at a time of deep division, but it was agreed without a timeline, as if to remind all parties that there was much still to be settled. In secular terms, this is one standard for everyone. The rule of law includes all. No one is above the law. What's good for me is good for you. Violations of this golden rule of human relations go to the heart of the nuclear dilemma. To give you a couple examples to think about of this double standards business, here are phrases you hear in discussions with representatives of the nuclear powers. And what's interesting is the Indian diplomats today sound just like the US diplomats did in 1950. The idea that we're a rising star, and these things, yeah, they're not really good things, but we have them, and we're going to get more of them, and you're just going to have to shut up. That's sort of the tone behind what you hear. We regret it, but we can do no other. So we will not let any nation tell us what to do, but we will tell others what they can do. We have weapons that pose a dire threat to human life, but we are guaranteeing security for the world. A dire threat guarantees security. Nuclear weapons are bad, but only in some hands. In our hands, they're acceptable and necessary. We don't want nuclear weapons used against us, but we are ready to use them against others if necessary. We have these weapons so that we'll never have to use them. We have them so... Remind you of anything in regular life? I think it reminds you of gun ownership. For the vast majority, they don't intend to use the gun, but we have it, so we won't have to use it. Yeah? So this is not on some outer star of experience. This is really close to right here. You know, the bomb, this is the bomb's home. Either implicitly, by default for most of us, directly by those who have to speak up for the policy, the doctrine. We must stop these weapons from spreading. We are disarming, and we'll keep working on it, but that's a separate issue. Meanwhile, we have to stop them spreading. Then the law of God, of all religions and of our country, is you shall not kill. But we have a weapon that kills thousands and millions of people indiscriminately and are prepared to use these weapons if necessary. And so you put those together, you see them applied in elaborate policies, and you come to a place where we are today, where there's a double standard that breaks the circle of security. And you could say that the circle of human security can only be ensured or built, developed, if we stick to one standard. The author, Jonathan Schell, whose book is not in our bookstore here, but I really recommend it to you if you are interested in many deep thoughts from a man who doesn't mention God, but the morality in the book and the spirituality behind it is very powerful. He points out that in a system of double standards, in a system of dominance, a double standard is a first principle. You know, you start with that as a given, and you don't accept any questioning of that. And so the idea of a double standard is a first principle. Could you get married and stay married with that? Could you raise your children in anything like the right way to go? What could you do with that approach to anything in human affairs? Any questions or comments? let me switch to the chance to hear some other people talking about this. I mentioned that if somebody near the projector could push the center button, please, thank you, John. And then somebody else hit the lights. Thank you, Michael.
Center to left, John.
Pardon?
Left.
The left one, yeah. Should it be twice?
Goes.
Once.
Yeah, there it goes. Is this light doable? I mentioned that various people at this point in history, and this is why the topic is quite current. In January 2007, we should be seeing the first part of that. There it comes. Okay, thanks. The projector is not on high alert. In January 2007, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, the Secretary of State under Reagan, Sam Nunn, Senator from Georgia, and William Perry, Defense Secretary under Reagan, right? Or was it Bush 1?
Bush 1.
Came, jointly signed an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, January 1st, 2007, in the Chronicle of Capitalism, saying that these lifelong Cold Warriors had now seen the light and really wanted us to get rid of these nuclear weapons. And it was a stunning change of atmosphere that really didn't take hold now until the change of administration took place, where the Obama administration has picked it up and really taken it forward. They wrote another one in January 08, and the ball has started to there's a snowball effect. I think 12 other countries, senior states, people, generally men, have gotten together and said, we agree. And it's actually a strategy of Pax Christi, the Roman Catholic peace movement, where Catholics are strong, to actually promote the creation of these gangs of four who come clean, usually late in life, on our need to move beyond this unconscionable weapon. So you'll hear now, as we start, Sam Nunn giving a beautiful example of a verse I didn't mention, but they shall beat their swords into plowshares. And he starts, Sam Nunn will come up, and he'll tell you how the weapons that used to be aimed at you on high alert are now running the light bulbs in your house. How could that be true? Listen to Sam.
Well, let me give you one example. We were able to make a deal in the 1990s to say to them, okay, you've got a value in your highly enriched uranium.
Talk about the Russians.
That are aimed at the United States. We will work with you to take that highly enriched uranium and let Russia process it. Take your weapon apart, let Russia process the highly enriched uranium in the low enriched uranium, which can be burned in power plants, and we will buy it. If you look at the electricity in this country, 19% of it comes from nuclear power. We're buying about half of the material we use in our nuclear power plants from the highly enriched uranium that has been blended down from those weapons. So mathematically, if you look at light bulbs in this country or any other form of electricity, 1 out of 10 light bulbs is coming from weapons that are aimed at us.
When nuclear material from dismantled warheads is used to light the homes of former enemies, swords are turned into plowshares.
That's Michael Douglas.
It shows what's possible.
Giving us Bible verses.
It gives us hope that the vision of the four Cold Warriors is achieved.
When we wrote the first article,
the Wall Street Journal editorial,
I thought it would be a statement that might attract the attention and occasional op-ed piece receives, but it generated an extraordinary amount of correspondence, many offers of participation by people that one would take very seriously.
The initial Wall Street Journal article created a wave of positive responses from around the globe and a growing political momentum for change. The British government has specifically embraced the initiative and has said it will be a disarmament laboratory to help lead a worldwide effort.
I expect that many, perhaps all of you here today, read an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal at the start of this year. The writers would be as familiar to an audience in this country as they are respected across the globe. George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn. The article made the case for, and I quote, a bold initiative consistent with America's moral heritage. That initiative was to reignite the vision of a world free of nuclear weapons and to redouble effort on the practical measures towards it. The need for such a vision and action is all too apparent.
A chain reaction of articles and opinion pieces by other senior statesmen from around the world and across party lines has turned the call of the American Four into a global dialogue. The Indian government has reaffirmed its commitment to a world without nuclear weapons. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd and former Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda announced the creation of an international commission on nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. Over two-thirds of living former U.S. Secretaries of State, Secretaries of Defense, and National Security Advisors have endorsed the initiative. Former President Gorbachev continues to work toward the goal of eliminating nuclear weapons.
Past this, as they put, the danger is that there are still too many nuclear weapons, and we need to start getting rid of those weapons. Secondly, the longer we have nuclear weapons and not just the existence of nuclear weapons that exist today, but possibly nuclear weapons in the hands of other countries, new nuclear powers, the more dangerous the situation is going to be. It's like that famous rifle on the wall, which will one day fire. U.S. leaders like Governor Schwarzenegger have also begun to speak out.
Everyone knows that I grew up in Austria. As a boy, the Red Army loomed over us from its bases in Central Europe. Now, even as a child, we all knew about the threat of nuclear weapons in the nuclear war. We knew the blinding power of its flash, and we knew the shape of its cloud. Over the years, the intense, glaring threat of nuclear war faded. All of a sudden, we didn't think about this anymore as the major threat or the major concern that people have and had always for 7 years during the Cold War. But the reality of it is today, the nuclear threat has returned with vengeance. The vengeance of a terrorist. See, there's a whole new world now since 9/11. The Soviets had nuclear weapons and didn't use them. And today, I mean, let's be honest, is there any doubt where the terrorists would use them?
Every U.S. president since President Johnson has pledged to work for the elimination of nuclear weapons as dictated by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And as recently as last May, all of the declared nuclear weapons states reaffirmed their, quote, unequivocal undertaking, unquote, toward that end. Great nations keep their word, and I, for one, will continue to push the U.S. and the other nuclear weapons states to fulfill their pledge.
President Obama has endorsed that goal as a fundamental tenet of his international policy.
The existence of thousands of nuclear weapons is the most dangerous legacy of the Cold War. Today, the Cold War has disappeared, but thousands of those weapons have not. In a strange turn of history, the threat of global nuclear war has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up. The technology to build a bomb has spread. Terrorists are determined to buy, build, or steal one. One nuclear weapon exploded in one city, be it New York or Moscow, Islamabad or Mumbai, Tokyo or Tel Aviv, Paris or Prague, could kill hundreds of thousands of people. And no matter where it happens, there is no end to what the consequences might be. So today, I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
Now, we harbor no illusions about the difficulty of bringing about a world without nuclear weapons. We know there are plenty of cynics and that there will be setbacks to prove their point. But there will also be days like today that push us forward, days that tell a different story. It is the story of a world that understands that no difference or division is worth destroying all that we have built and all that we love. It is a recognition that can bring people of different nationalities and ethnicities and ideologies together. In my own country, it has brought Democrats and Republican leaders together. Leaders like George Shultz, Bill Kerry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, who are with us here today.
Senator McCain voiced his commitment to nuclear disarmament both in his 2008 presidential campaign and again on the floor of the United States Senate.
We should stop and think for a moment, not only the perils of a world awash with nuclear weapons, but also of the more hopeful alternative, a world in which there are far fewer such weapons than there are today, and in which proliferation, instability, and nuclear terrorism are far less likely. A quarter of a century ago, Ronald Reagan declared, "Our dream is to see the day when nuclear weapons will be banished from the face of the earth." That is my dream, too.
Meeting in London, President Obama and Russian President Medvedev released a statement saying, "We committed our two countries to achieving a nuclear weapons-free world."
I believe that we are in a race between cooperation and catastrophe in terms of making sure we do not have catastrophic nuclear terrorism and all of the good things I can imagine for the future, my children, my grandchildren, depend on preventing the catastrophes that could result from a nuclear bomb going off in one of our cities. That could dramatically change our life in ways we cannot imagine and curtail the dreams of all of the other things we want to happen.
Okay, if we could have the lights again and the projector off. Questions or comments? Yes.
Well, a few years back, I had heard that the United States was in the process of financing and redesigning our nuclear weapons to match the new technology.
Right.
Has that been removed off the budget?
Yeah. Not exactly. Congress has voted that down again and again. The reliable replacement warhead is the main program, I think. The warheads are more than 25 years old now, but they'll last 100 years with oil and water. And, you know, kitty litter. But Obama already promised, I think, a $10 billion increase in what's called the nuclear complex, which is Los Alamos and Sandia and the Nevada test site. So the idea is we're going to have less weapons, but we got to keep the ones we have in good shape. So we're going to spend more on keeping the ones we have. Yeah, but it doesn't include a new warhead officially, and that keeps getting batted down. But that's a key red line.
Including for a while, there was discussion about a nuclear bunker buster.
Yeah, that's hopefully, you know, God help us, that's part of those people that were in power until about 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair to say.
That's been taken off and that they're not spending money on it? Because to me, this seems entirely inconsistent to say that you're going to decrease and eliminate nuclear weapons, but we're going to spend money making them better.
Polarized Washington. John can help. John Marty can help us with any such questions. I'm sure. What I'd like to do is spend the time we have left trying to give you a little bit of idea of what we can do as churches And I'm passing around, sorry about upstairs, I'll give you all copies later, I think there's enough. But I'm passing around a really cool map. And it looks like this. And what it is it's all of the nuclear weapon-free zones in existence. And I've also got a news story that I will pass around, where we went out on a limb and we made a prediction. And just to show you that advocacy can actually work a little bit sometimes if you're not too ambitious in a difficult area. So here's the January 27th story from the World Council News, Church's news story, news service. Will the world be safer from nuclear danger in 2009? Many, including churches, say yes. And the first couple words are, prepare for some good news in 2009. Despite the terrible start in Gaza, remember that little war there for 27 days, and other endemic conflicts, governments committed to shared security are set to reach a historic milestone this year. Specifically, the number of countries protected by nuclear weapon-free zones is set to jump to 116 countries from 56 at present. The change will come from an African capital like Windhoek or Bujumbura, as soon as two more governments ratify the treaty, making Africa a nuclear weapon-free zone. Churches are promoting the step and linking Africa's action to the need for similar progress in the Middle East. Well, that was 27th of January, and here we are, 3rd of September. Another news story. With recent action by Africa, a majority of the world's countries have now banned nuclear weapons from their national territory for the first time. The change happened when an all-Africa treaty entered into force in July. International civil society organizations, including the World Council of Churches, played a catalytic role, taking a shared approach to a safer world. How's that for a phrase? Leave here with that in your mind, a shared approach to a safer world. Africa became a nuclear weapon-free zone when Burundi became the 28th state to ratify the Treaty of Pelindaba. A World Council delegation visited the Central African country in March 2009 to encourage the step. And that's enough for to give you an idea. Those of you who want to read a bit more, I'll pass these around. I'll start the prediction on that side and the fulfillment of prophecy on this side. And just let me explain. The treaty, the NPT that you heard them talk about, I mentioned earlier, says that if you're one of the 184 countries who are going to go into this promising never to have nuclear weapons, you can actually fortify your status by forming a nuclear weapon-free zone. And I think the biggest parallel is the drug-free zones, the handgun-free buildings, the, you know, wherever you try to make a space safe, I would say a little holy. Well, this is a great idea, and you know who did it first? Led by Mexico. This one over here, the numbers is the rough sequence of when these zones were created. The treaty, and you get a prize if you can say this, of Tlatelolco, a town in Mexico where they negotiated, and they did this, why? Because Latin America couldn't believe their eyes and ears and hearts during and after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they said, holy smokes, Caribbean island facing off with Russian missiles against USA, the world's coming that close to blowing itself to pieces. Never again, at least in our backyard, they formed this nuclear weapon-free zone. And basically what the zones do is they say you can't have nuclear weapons. The nations in them already agreed to that for themselves. But you guys up there, and notice that all the nuclear powers are in the north, yeah. Half of the world, except for India and Pakistan, which dipped down a bit. You guys who got them, you can't bring them here, you can't park them here, you can't base them here, you can't test them here. And there's a couple other things that they exclude. The last and most developed of these treaties is the Treaty of Pelindaba, the one for Africa. Pelindaba, interestingly enough, is the place where the white racist regime, the apartheid regime in South Africa, developed and built 6 nuclear weapons. And actually, by many, many reports, tested them in the South Atlantic down here near Antarctica, possibly in collaboration with Israel. If you're Israel and you have nuclear weapons, which they do, we're even going to test them. So they got together with, notice how, you know, people who have bad things on their mind need other people with bad things on their mind to get them done. Well, South Africa, when it fell, the black regime gave up the weapons, the ANC regime, Nelson Mandela and company, and they negotiated it and signed it in 96. So I give this as an example of church advocacy. The World Council of Churches is a lot of people, a lot of churches, 350 denominations, different groups from different denominations, mostly Protestant and Orthodox, in about 110 countries. But, you know, we don't have a big huge budget, big huge staff. A lot of people in the churches don't even know their church is a member. So what are you going to do with the little power you have? Well, our membership is scattered around the world, much like the nuclear weapons are, and most of them are non-nuclear weapon states. And you look at the scene and you say, gee, Africa only needs four more. I think when we started, only four more countries to ratify their signature on that treaty, and it will be, in one fell swoop, 58 more countries who are in a nuclear weapon-free zone, joining this coalition of the small states. And that happened with a couple of visits, and Bujumbura was the place where it happened. And I just tell you, it's kind of gratifying to set up something where you bring a respected local church leader, the Anglican Archbishop of Bujumbura, Burundi. You bring a Kenyan diplomat who is a devout Anglican. Also, we had two Anglicans, but that was okay. God didn't strike us down for non-inclusivity. And we went to see the leaders of Burundi. And we went, actually, in the path the treaty had to go to get ratified. So we went from justice to parliament to the vice president to the president's office or something like that, in that order. And spoke to each one. And the thing I remember best was the vice president, who we learned when we came into the room, he said, "You're the church and you're here to talk about peace, you're welcome." Remember Burundi. Burundi came that far, that close to having exactly the same experience as Rwanda. It's the same ethnic makeup, it's right next door. It had 20 years of bad, bad things happening between an oppressed minority and a somewhat privileged minority. You're here to talk about peace, you're welcome. Another thing that the head of the Senate told us is, our neighbors helped us when we were in such trouble for 20 years. Now we want to help them. They've sent troops to Somalia, for example. The main troops in Somalia are Burundian. A third thing would be, they look at this treaty to have a non-nuclear weapon, a nuclear weapon-free zone, and they say, disarmament is a question of governance and peace. And you kind of wish you might hear that here sometime, you know, with the number of weapons we have, and people willing to call Obama the best gun salesman in American history. As another way, you know, the dominance, the power versus the consent, and the agreement-building approach to politics. For the first time now, the Central Asian states have made a zone themselves, and Mongolia, heroic Mongolia, surrounded by nuclear powers, has made itself into a nuclear weapon-free state all by itself. And the Mongolian ambassadors go around at these meetings trying to get support for that position, trying to get recognition. Because all the powers are asked to promise never to attack these people. If these people do this, they turn to the nuclear power and say, "Now you sign the protocol which says you will never attack us because we've done this in keeping with the treaty." And by all those little steps, you slowly secure part of the world against this threat, and you chip away at the global domination and the global threat of the weapon. That's, I think, a good example of translating the ideas which those Bible verses evoke, you know, the idea of God so loved the world, and you know, all the standards that we aspire to by God's grace and following in the footsteps of Jesus, which make diplomats absolutely nervous, even if they're Christian, because they're not, "Wait a minute, that's not my job." But you may manage to share that in one way or another as the basis for why you're there, but you boil it down to something specific, which is relevant to the ultimate goal of abolition. The ultimate goal of Obama used the phrase, and it's repeated over and over again now, the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. Not the world we live in now, but a world that can handle other problems that require our participation, our commitment, our organizational skills, our collaboration, and other things like that. One more quick example might be to say that we are told something which relates our work to yours. I'm saying our as a global body, which represents your churches, basically, if you're all from the kind of churches that come here. When we talk to the delegations, they say, this is great, we agree with you, because most of the countries, especially all the non-nuclear countries, and on certain issues, the nuclear countries, want to move forward on this. They've all said they want to. Every single one has said they want to. But we need to hear about it in capital. And if we hear about it in capital, then we're more likely to be able to do something at the treaty meetings. And the issue on the table right now for you, and we'll only have time to go into this and leave it with you to take home. Is anybody here from a state that has a Republican senator or two? Probably keep having it holding. Nobody from Republican states comes here. Pardon?
We have one.
Okay, let's gather around and pray. What's your name, sir? John Ellis?
Yeah, we have one.
You had one or you have one?
We do not. We have.
Okay, then there's nobody. We can't pray for anybody. Anybody up there? You got a Republican senator? Well, the problem is Obama and Medvedev have signed something called the New START or START 2. It goes back to one of the more successful agreements done under Bush 1, and it takes some of the cuts that Bush 2 agreed to but did without any verification. He didn't want any verification, didn't want any inspections or anything. Puts verification into the treaty, drops the numbers down, and under the influence of these commitments, Hillary's first words, basically, at the NPT meeting in May, the big meeting of the treaty where all the countries come together once every 5 years, was, we're going to tell you how many nuclear weapons we have. As at an event at lunch the next day, the U.S. delegation sat there, and everybody was listening. Everybody knew what the answer was. And they said 5,113. Well, those are the deployed ones. They have more than that sitting in the garage that still work, and they can use them anytime they want. But it was a start. Transparency. You know, the first step to security is transparency. Anyway, this modest treaty may not get a vote before the election and may not even be able to be passed after the next election if the Senate goes more Republican. And so the people, John Kerry's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee where it's currently under hearings. He postponed the vote in the committee till the middle of September. He has one Republican and the Democratic majority, but they can't take it out of the Senate committee to the Senate with only one Republican. That's Richard Lugar from Indiana, who knows the issue really well. He's behind that program they told you about, the light bulbs and the Russian bomb fuel. So there's a church coalition and many other coalitions working on getting 5 or 6 or 7 Republican votes for this very modest treaty, which reaps, it's the first of many steps that need to happen. Remember the treaty on comprehensive test ban that was before the Senate and went down in Clinton times? Mm-hmm. An enormously important step, which has been on the books for 20 years, but we haven't ratified it. And because we haven't ratified it, China's not gonna ratify it. I don't think India's ratified it. Israel is not gonna ratify it. There's about 15 countries waiting to see what we'll do. It crashed and burned the ratification step in the Senate about the time that Clinton was having some personal issues that took away from his power. Mm-hmm. And it's an enormous pity that this commitment not to test again isn't fulfilled. So in a word, the thing to take from here is you're not from states that have Republican senators, but if you get one in November, go to breakfast with them instantly, please, and tell them to please think about security in terms that other people can recognize as security. Security on the side of agreements and treaties that reduce pressures and move us in the direction we need to go, rather than security of, we need these weapons and those guys out there are all benighted and we're not gonna make any deal with them because our nation is sovereign. And on this issue, no nation is sovereign. People are sovereign, humanity is sovereign. The common good is the sovereign. And all of those are, I think, inclining us towards God's promises. And this saga, which is now, as the title says, in its seventh decade, has got to end. So thank you for your time. If you've got specific questions, I'm here. I'm going to do something different next week, but it's not unrelated. We'll talk about Israel in this context a little bit as we talk about just peace. What is just peace, and how is peace a lot closer to you than you might think, because you don't work in stuff like this. Honestly, it makes a difference to us if there are people who talk to their senators, talk to their congressmen about international issues. You know, pick the thing you didn't like the most up here under the financial and environmental, and let your write handwritten letters, all the stuff you've ever heard by advocacy, let them know that you care that we spend less money on defense and start with nuclear weapons. Go see them if you can. At least tell other people about your concern in your parish. Show things like that video. I think they're available free. It's called Turning Point, nuclearturningpoint.org. And bring back a little bit of the public concern that was driving some of the agreements earlier in the nuclear era. There's a possibility. Yes, sir.
Yeah, could you explain, because you said, do we have Republican senators? Can you explain the subtlety as to why it's the senators that we're...
Well, the Senate has to ratify treaties.
Okay.
And you need to do it with two-thirds. And there are 59 Democrats, and I think Lieberman's with the Democrats on this one.
Okay.
And then you can add up the two women from Vermont, Snow and...
So...
And a couple others, and you get there, but we need about five or six more.
But...
I have the exact names.
And I know that... And that's what I thought it was, that the Senate ratifies treaties, but... working through Republican House of Representatives to have them be a voice within the Republican Party. That's the other issue is that if the party itself finds that it's losing, or that, you know, that people are advocating against them or for them, mm-hmm. for a particular stance, then, you know, then they should be a voice within that particular party that party comes out and says, this is no longer a viable political position, right?
Yeah. Congressmen have this responsibility,
right.
per year.
Yeah, because the one that I keep coming back at, because I have a Republican House of Representatives, and I keep coming back and saying, look, you as a Republican say that you're the one that you are the spokesman for being the fiscally responsible, and yet look at where you're willing to spend money.
Yeah.
So either be consistent and be fiscally responsible and call for a reduction in the expenditure on these issues, or stop telling the rest of us that you're the fiscally responsible
exactly.
party. Point out that the cost, you know, the cost of these things is where the cost is really going to. It isn't to the social programs that you're trying to, you know, so that issue about the 1.5 and, you know, the trillions of dollars, to me this is a statistic that I send to my Republican House of Representatives.
Atomic
say,
audit.
And
just Google it. Atomic audit.
That's right. You just say, you know, you know you're going to come out, you're going to campaign for being fiscally responsible. Here's where you cut money.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take over 55% of what we spend off the books for a cutting, and you only leave this, you know, you're asking a subset to absorb the cost. So start taking it off of this.
The world's defense spending has climbed, and now it's higher than it ever was in the Cold War.
Yep.
The U.S. used to do half, so we spend as much on our defense as the rest of the world put together.
That's right.
And you're supposed to be all afraid about China and Iran and everybody else who's such mean characters going to get us. But we're spending as much as all of them put together. Now it's climbed. We're at we do $500 billion a year, so half a trillion a year. It's climbed. They're spending money too. You know, we had an economic boom. China's building up a little bit. A lot of people are building up, using high-tech weapons and stuff. Some countries are making a killing. Remember, the biggest arms sales countries are what? The five permanent members of the Security Council. So the people guaranteed to keep our peace and security, international peace and security, are the biggest arms merchants and the biggest arms spenders. But we are somehow thinking we need to do that. It's a bit less than half now because others are growing to catch up. And this is that's the nuclear part of it. And I think it's incredibly vulnerable financially, morally, ethically, absolutely off the charts, but also politically because of all that. You guys are supposed to be liberated on time. You stayed here beyond your time. Let me just tell that if anybody's really interested, I have, these are going cheap now at the end of the week, a photocopy of the telegram sent by the first European into Hiroshima, the Red Cross representative, making a very sober assessment of the bound. This guy named Bilfinger. The combined works. Michael is a couple steps closer to heaven than he was yesterday because he took a copy yesterday. You can have the combined works of the ecumenical community on disarmament from 1948 to 2001, right here. And another news story about that meeting in New York where I mentioned, here's Michael Kinneman, the head of the National Council of the Churches, shaking hands with the British ambassador after we had talked with them. And then for those of you who won't be able to take this because somebody else will take it, I have it all boiled down into one sheet. And then a statement of the last, one of the last big statements by the WCC on the issue. So you're welcome to help yourself. Thank you for your attention.